On Radio Jackie today, I'm joined by Paul Scully, who is the MP for Sutton and Cheam. You have announced you will stand down at the next general election. What made you come to this decision?
Well, I was never a career decision to become an MP. I was running small businesses. I wanted to represent my local area, not just travel around the country to be an MP. And so I never wanted to make a final retirement as MP, shuffling around in the Commons when I was in my 80s. And now we're in a difficult position as a party. And to come back, I'm not going to be part of the long-term solution. So better for me to go now. Send a warning shot to my colleagues of how they need to rebuild the party, and then let someone else pick up that. I think Sutton and Cheam is really winnable still. I'm not turning my back on Sutton. There's still lots to do, building the new hospital, sorting out the high street for the 21st century. But I'll be working with my successor to help him do that or her do that.
Now, you've said the Conservative Party has lost its way. How so?
Well, I think it's lost its focus. So we've been through, the country has been through some huge global issues, you know, with the picking up on the financial meltdown of 2008, having to pay down the debt then, which allowed us to then get into the, to spend the £408 billion during COVID and allowed us the money to help people recover with their energy costs. But in doing so, we just still remain in crisis mode. What we've got to be doing over these coming months in the lead up to the general election is articulating the vision for the next 5 years, not just managing what's going on at the moment, but giving people hope and an aspirational vision for that. That's what's missing at the moment.
And what do you think the party needs to do to regain focus now?
Well, I think just stop talking to it, talking to itself about itself and actually re-engage with people. We're human beings first, politicians second. And I just think re-engaging with people. So across the generations, so we're speaking to younger people, for example, and meeting younger people's aspirations, because otherwise what we're doing is not only just risking this general election, but we're not giving any reason for younger people to vote for us the next time and the time after that.
Okay, moving on. You have been accused of Islamophobia after making claims of no-go areas in Tower Hamlets and Spark Hill in Birmingham, both of which have large Muslim populations. Do you regret saying this?
I regret using the term because it has connotations for some people that I just didn't mean. I was actually arguing the opposite. And what I really regret is that then means it's distracted from what I was trying to say. I was calling out some of the anti-Muslim words that we heard, in particular from Lee Anderson, and saying that they have been allowed to flourish because of people's prejudices. When people feel uncomfortable going into an area, in this case, a large Muslim area, but could be where there are black gangs, there are white gangs, etc. And that feeds people's prejudice on a whole community just because of the actions of a small community, of a small group of people. That's what I was trying to say. Problem is, you can't do nuance and community relations at 7:05 in a 12-minute interview where people grab 3 or 4 of your words and use that on social media. So I regret the fact that I ended up actually being portrayed as some as arguing the exact opposite of what I was trying to do, having worked with Muslim communities, especially British Bangladeshis, the Ahmadiyya community locally, for 15 years or so now.
Yeah, well, you said in an interview on the newsagent that Lee Anderson's comments about Sadiq Khan giving our capital away to Islamists was stoking up division. Some may say that the comments you made would be doing the same.
Well, as I say, I think, you know, there are people that do feel uncomfortable going into other areas. I didn't mean that as a no-go area, as some barricades and the police don't go in there. But, you know, I've had the media say, oh, well, tell you what, why don't I take you into Tower Hamlets? Why don't I take you into Spark Hill and show you what a lovely place it is? I know these places. I know I don't not go to those areas. What we need to do is actually go around the surrounding areas, ask people why they do sometimes feel uncomfortable, understand why they are fueling those prejudices, and then tackle them. That's the wider point. If we don't have that discussion and then we just say everything's rosy, then it does give space and oxygen for the people on the extreme side, the prejudiced people on the extreme side, to use and stoke up their rhetoric.
Now, obviously, these comments no doubt will have caused concern for residents. What are you doing to tackle prejudice in the area?
Well, I've written over the last week and done a lot of media interviews to really explain what I meant and to really get that discussion going about tackling people. Imagine if you're a Jewish person working in a walking around a certain area, a gay person working around a certain area, or indeed a Muslim person walking around certain areas. You're going to feel that uncomfortable. What can we do to have one community, not just a series of communities? And that's what I mean. I speak regularly with the Ahmadiyya community, the mosques around Sutton, the Muslim Turks in Sutton, the Muslim Bangladeshis in Sutton, the Muslim Pakistanis in Sutton, and indeed across London. It's that discourse that helps us tackle this issue and reassure people.
And what are you doing to reassure the Muslim community specifically?
Well, as I say, it is speaking to them directly and really making sure that they understand that they do have people speaking up for them in Parliament, speaking up for them across London, so that we're not segmenting one community and peeling off one community to pitch them up against another. We have all of these disparities across London and the country. And as I say, we need to do more to bring one community together. So that's my engagement with them, I hope, gives that reassurance.
Moving on to the Horizon scandal, which is still ongoing. You were in the chamber a few weeks ago pressing the minister to get life-changing compensation to sub-postmasters in time for August. How did that go? What's the update?
Yeah, so there's been a distraction over the last couple of weeks with a lot of discussion around sort of dysfunctional management in the post office, with talk about the chief exec's bonus and what the chairman did and didn't say, which just distracts from getting the money out. But I know that because I speak to him, not just in the chamber, the current Post Affairs Minister, Kevin Holenrae, is working hard to get that life-changing money out. He was the one that set the target of August. And I think, I will keep pressing him to make sure he sticks to that target. That should be everybody apart from the people who have got convictions to be quashed, because we've got to get the legislation through. So I hope that if we get that done, then those people can start getting compensation as well shortly after. It probably won't get done by August, but it will be months, not another. I don't. We shouldn't be here another year talking about this.
Do you think sub postmasters will be seeing compensation anytime soon? Do you think that target of August will be hit?
I think for most of them, yes, they'll be getting offers. I think obviously, it's for them to then be coming back if they're not happy with the offer, and go through mediation, go through whatever process they need to do. There's an independent committee that checks over that. So it's not just post office marking their homework or government marking its own homework. And it's the postmaster's right to obviously push back and say, no, that's not nearly enough. That's where the August date might be pushed against. But that's definitely the intention, that they should get most, absolutely most of them should get an offer by then.
And finally, you are running the London Marathon in April, aren't you? So it's going to come around very, very quickly, a month and a bit away. How are you feeling about it?
Oh, I'll tell you what, I've got to get on, push up, probably put another push out for some fundraising after this for the Royal Marsden. People can see on my pinned tweet and on my Facebook. And if they're getting emails from me, there's a link to my page there. But I've got to go and do 11K. Today, at some point, I've got to find the time. It's getting harder. The longer the runs, the harder I've got to find the time. And then on Sunday, I've got to do 20 miles, 32K. So that takes up a good chunk of my Sunday morning, running around there. But I keep trying to pretend that it's just a repetitive task, putting one foot in front of another for a few hours, to try and persuade myself that there is no pain. But it'll be worth it in the end.
And do you train by yourself, or do you have someone training with you to kind of spur you on?
No, I do it myself. I do it myself. I usually put music or an audio book on or something like that. It's actually quite nice for mindfulness as well. It just gets me away from everything. Funnily enough, we were talking about the anti-Muslim stuff, the no-go stuff earlier on. It really sort of shook me and angered me and upset me, the response to that on the Monday. And I was out at 4 o'clock in the morning because I couldn't sleep. And it was a great way of therapy to actually just pound the streets, and have time for myself.
No, exercise is very good for your mental health, isn't it? And just final question. Obviously, you've probably got a target of fundraising, which you told us about last time. How's that going? How far away are you from that? And what would you say to people to encourage them to donate as little or as much as possible?
Yeah, I'm only in the few hundreds at the moment. I've got to get into the thousands. So it's for the Royal Marsden, and which is an amazing institute that we are lucky to have, the Royal Marsden campus in Sutton. It's a world-leading cancer hospital, probably one of the best in the world, and it will be there for us if we need it. We know the high percentages of people that have cancer. I've lost loved ones that have been treated. I think we all know someone. Yes, it's an NHS hospital, but the cancer that runs in parallel does it, does so much, especially for children, especially for young people, to add value to their lives at a time when they're at their weakest and most vulnerable.